one day I walked around the MIT campus and I put 6 packs of Coke in the refrigerators, and I came back from time to time to check on my Coke. So Cokes would disappear really quickly. But if instead of Coke I put a plate with 6 $1 bills, nobody ever touched those. Now, they could have taken the dollar bill and go to the machine and just get a Coke, but it feels very, very differently. And I frankly worry about moving from a society that is removed from cash. We have PayPal and we have electronic transaction, and whether those things actually make it easier for us to cheat and feel good about ourselves.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Neda Ulibi. Behavioral economist Dan Ariely was an 18-year-old in the Israeli army when a magnesium flare he was standing near suddenly exploded. Third-degree burns covered his body. Ariely's painful 3-year rehabilitation in a hospital burn unit made him think about the concept of irrational behavior. Eventually, that puzzle became a pursuit that's guided Ariely's academic life. The title of Dan Ariely's new book is Predictably Irrational: The Hidden Forces That Shape Our Decisions. It examines real-life decision-making, which Ariely says differs drastically from the way economists are taught to envision it. Classic economic models assume people act rationally in their own best interests. Dan Ariely says we're creatures of impulse who waste money, underestimate risks, and procrastinate. Sound familiar? Ariely hopes his studies, which cover everything from all-you-can-eat buffets to unprotected sex, will teach us how to overcome misguided impulses, or at least avoid them. This reading of Predictably Irrational, The Hidden Forces That Shape Our Decisions, was recorded in February 2008 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C.
So one of the things we learned is that people don't know really how good or bad something is, and expectations make a big difference. So if you expect something to be very good, you can actually get more disappointed. So let's lower your expectation, please. And let's start. So let me start by telling you how I started writing this book. So I don't know how many of you read academic papers, but they're boring to read and they're boring to write to the most degree. So a few years ago, I decided to write something different, and I decided to write a cookbook. And the title of my cookbook was going to be Dining Without Crumbs, The Art of Eating Over the Sink. It was going to be a guide for the single male and female about how to view life through the kitchen, and also some cooking and recipes and so on. And I shopped it around, and nobody was interested. They say it's funny, but it's not cookbook, it's not humor, it's not research, what is it? And eventually somebody said, why don't you write something about your research? And if you get this book published, you could write your cookbook. So this was the motivation, and I'm happy to tell you that I started working back on my cookbook at some point. So let me tell you how I started becoming interested in irrationality. It turns out that one of the things I'll talk about is how when emotion takes over us, we become different people, and sometimes we can't estimate that. And, you know, a minute ago I was thinking I was not going to be emotional. And all of a sudden, when I was just about to talk about it, I became emotional. It's kind of amazing that I was unable to predict it. So I'm going to try one last time. I hope I can make it. So I was in the burn department for many years. And one of the worst thing in the burn department is what's called the bath treatment. This is where they take the patients and undo their bandages. And you all had Band-Aid at some point, and you know it's a little bit painful. But just imagine that it's 70% of your body and you have no skin whatsoever. It's just incredibly painful, and it takes a long time to do every day. And because this was kind of the mainly daily torture, I would have continuous debate with the nurses about how this should be done. You can think about different processes. Do you want to have the intensity low and stretch it over a couple of hours, or should the nurses just rip the bandage off quickly and have it over a shorter duration, maybe an hour? Do you want to start from the most painful part of the body and move to the least painful, or do you want to do the opposite? Do you give breaks? Don't you give breaks? I mean, there's all kinds of questions. You have to deliver this pain. What is the best way to do it? Kind of mechanics of pain, right? What would create the least memory and the least intensity at the end of the day? And as the word patient implies, you don't have much control. You're supposed just to sit there and be patient and let them do whatever they want. And the nurses had their own approach, and I had my own prediction of what's a better approach, and they didn't listen to me. And, you know, we kept on debating for months and months and months, and this was it. When I got out of the hospital and I started studying at the university, I discovered the experimental method. I discovered that if you have a question, you can bring it to an experiment, and you can have two conditions, and you can figure out who is right and who is wrong. And one of the first experiments I did was to bring people to the lab and hurt them in different ways. So I would get people to experience longer duration of pain and shorter duration of pain, higher intensity, lower intensity, increasing, decreasing, and so on. By the way, if you wonder how I got people to agree to participate, it turns out it's not that difficult to get people to participate in pain. And also, I had this wonderful research assistant. She was a very beautiful woman, and she would come to people around campus and said, "Can I hurt you?" And almost everybody, followed her. So I kept on doing these experiments, and at the end of the day, what I learned was that the nurses were wrong. Their approach was to rip the bandages fast and get it over with. And it turns out that that was not the best way to minimize the pain. That a much better way would have been to have a lower intensity of pain over longer duration. It would have been better to start from the most intense pain and go down over time. And it would have been good to take breaks. Now, aside from one nurse, which I had real issues with, all the nurses were fantastic. They were generous, wonderful individuals who dedicated their life to help the patient. They also had a tremendous amount of experience. So they were good, well-meaning, and with a lot of experience, and nevertheless, they got it wrong. The question is, how can somebody good, well-meaning, and with a lot of experience get it wrong? And I started thinking, are there other cases in life where good intentions and a lot of experience are just not a guarantee for getting things right? And from that point on, I decided that every place in life where I think these phenomena happens is a fair approach to investigation, and I just started looking at things. Let me say one more thing, which is about the fun of being a social scientist. I think one of the fun thing is that, you know, we think about kind of the mysteries in life, and we think about space, and we think about molecular biology, and it's true that those are big mysteries, but it turns out that there's also a lot of mysteries just around us, in how we behave, and how we do, and why we drink coffee, and all kinds of wonderful things. And if you think about our daily life as kind of a chemistry set to studying human behavior, it's really wonderful what kind of experiments you could do with just the regular things you have at home, in a sense, on human behavior. So let me tell you about a few experiments. Let me start by telling you a little bit about cheating. So you might remember Enron from a few years ago. And when Enron erupted, I started thinking about cheating. And I thought about the following. First of all, the architects of Enron looked like evil, mean people who were up to get us. I mean, they got a lot of the U.S. economy, something like $40 billion. But at the same time, when you read the stories about them, they looked like good people. I mean, they gave money to charity, they were involved in the community. How could it be that these seemingly good people were doing these awful things? And this is a thought experiment that, of course, we can't run, but I was asking myself, do I think that they would have stolen $1,000 from somebody's backpack or wallet if they knew they would never be caught? And it didn't look to me from the description about those people that they would. Of course, we can't know. The second thing that I wondered about was, how could Enron collect all these evil people in one company? I mean, what was the HR department like? And I don't think, you know, that was their goal or it was a part of their process. So how could that be? So I basically started doing experiments on cheating to find out how much do we all cheat and what gets us to cheat more and what gets us to cheat less. So I did the following simple experiment. I would take a sheet of paper, and I would write 20 simple math problems on it. And these were math problems. Each of them, you had 12 numbers, and you had to find the two numbers in those that add to 10, right? Something that everybody can do. We can all count, add two numbers to 10. But it takes a while to figure out which of these two numbers add to 10. And there were 20 problems like this on a sheet. And when people finished, I would pay them by performance. I would give them $1 per question. And I didn't give people enough time to do it, so I gave them only 5 minutes. So I would hand in those sheets, 5 minutes were over, I would take these things back, and I would pay them. And on average, people solved 4 problems. Okay, so they ate $4. That's the control condition. This is the condition where nobody can cheat. That's just how much people are able to do. Then I had another condition. It was exactly the same, but when they finished, I said, please shred the piece of paper and tell me how many questions you solved. Now, presumably by telling them, giving them those instructions, they don't become any smarter. And the difference between 4 and what they tell me is cheating. And people said 7. Okay? So these, by the way, are Harvard, MIT, Yale, Princeton, UCLA students. Now, interestingly enough, a lot of people cheated a little bit. We almost didn't have anybody, almost anybody, from thousands of people we tested, I think like three or four, cheated a lot. But more than 50% cheated a little bit. So, by the way, if you think about me as an economy of how much money I lost to cheating, I lost 100 times more to the good people who cheated a little bit than to the evil people who cheated a lot. And I'll come back to this because this is actually reflected in what happens in the economy. If you, just as a kind of as a way to think about this, the market for car burglary and home theft and arsony together is $16 billion. It's hard to figure out with these big numbers, is it big or small? So here are two other numbers. The market for wardrobing. Wardrobing is when people go and buy clothes in the clothes store, they wear it to a party, they return it to the store in the condition that the store can't resell it. Is also, the clothing industry estimates that they lose for this practice, this one practice, every year, $16 billion. So in some sense, this activity that we're all afraid of and worried about and spend so much time is of the same economic magnitude as one consumer activity. And by the way, the estimated market for in-company theft and fraud is $600 billion a year. So the differences between the crimes that we seem to care about and think about and between the crime of good people who are taking office supply is dramatic in terms of the economic implications. Okay, so now the question is, why do people cheat just a little bit? Maybe they think they can get away with it. Maybe it is the economic incentives. So we did experiments in which we changed the probability of catching people. How did we do it? They shredded more of the piece of paper, they shredded less. Some people got outside and paid themselves from a big jar of money that had over $100 and they just paid how much they wanted. Didn't matter. When we changed the probability of catching them, nobody cheated more. Cheating remained the same. When we changed the amount of money that they were about to get, between 10 cents to 50 cents to $2, again, cheating didn't go up. So it didn't seem to be about the probability of being caught. It didn't seem to be about how much money you stand to gain. You know, presumably if we went to $1 million per question, it would go up. But within a very reasonable range, it didn't go up. What was it? So we thought maybe people cheat up to the level that they're comfortable with. So we all want to stare ourselves in the mirror and feel good about ourselves. I'm kind of a good person. But we also have these incentives to get financial benefits from cheating. So maybe what we do is we cheat up to the level that we can still stare ourselves in the mirror and feel good about ourselves. Now, if that's the question, if that's the mechanism, that it has a few implications. One implication is if it's making more difficult for us to stare ourselves in the mirror and feel good about ourselves, we would cheat less. And the other thing is if we would create a situation in which we can stare ourselves in the mirror and think better about ourselves, we would cheat more. So that's what we try to do. How do we get people to cheat less and how do we get people to cheat more? So to cheat less, we wanted to get people aware of their own morality standard. We just wanted them to think morality when they come to our experiment. So what did we do? We had our experiment, as I described to you. But before that, we invited people to another experiment. And that experiment we called the memory experiment. What did we do in the memory experiment? Half the people were asked to recall 10 books they read in college. Half the people were asked to recall the 10 commandments. Now, I don't know if you can recall the 10 commandments. Most people can't. And then they moved to our experiment. What happened? The people who recalled the 10 commandments, first of all, didn't get any better in math, if you think that that helps. But the second thing is they stopped cheating. There was no cheating whatsoever after recalling 10 commandments. So this suggests that when people think about their own morality, they're more aware of it, they can't get away with cheating. They basically are having a more stringent standard for looking themselves in the mirror and feeling good about it. We did the same thing, by the way, with the honor code. It turns out that when people sign an honor code, even if they shred the piece of paper with the honor code, they stop cheating. And I can tell you more about this. But then we said, okay, so how do we get people to cheat more? And not that we want to get people to cheat more, but to understand the process behind it, we wanted to get people to cheat more. So we did the following experiment. We had one condition that people solved and gave us and solved four. One condition they shred, they said they solved seven. Another condition, they shredded a piece of paper, but when they came to us, they said, Mr. Experimenter, I solved X problems, give me X tokens. Okay? We didn't give them cash, we gave them tokens. And then they walked 12 feet to the side and exchanged a token per dollar. Now, why is that important? Let me give you, before I give you the results, let me tell you a few things. How would you feel about taking a pencil from work home, You don't have to answer. Versus, how would you feel about taking 10 cents from a petty cash box? In economic terms, those could be equivalent. I'm not sure how much a pencil costs these days, but let's say they're equivalent. Nevertheless, they feel very differently. And this was the intuition. And indeed, when we asked people to get a token first, they doubled their cheating. Now think about that. Think about how worrisome it is. We're moving to a society that is removed from cash. And if every step you go away from cash make it easier for us to cheat, what does it mean about backdating stock options? Think about how many steps this is removed. And think for yourself, how bad would you feel if you just backdated your stock options? I mean, it's not money, it's stocks, it's not stocks, it's stock options. It's not really adding a number, it's just backdating. People could feel perfectly fine morally about themselves and nevertheless commit these very expensive crimes. There's this joke that said that a kid comes home with a note that he took a pencil from the kid who was sitting next to him. And his father is saying, David, I'm so embarrassed, I'm so humiliated, we don't educate you like this, we didn't brought you up like this, what are you thinking, how do you behave, I'm so embarrassed. And besides, if you need pencils, just ask, I can bring you a dozen from work. So it turns out that this is much more closer to reality than we want to admit. I'll tell you one other version of this is, one day I walked around the MIT campus and I put 6 packs of Coke in the refrigerators. These are common refrigerators. And I came back from time to time to check on my Coke. And the half-time life of Coke is very short. Let me just say. So Cokes would disappear really quickly. But if instead of Coke I put a plate with 6 $1 bills, nobody ever touched those. Now, they could have taken the dollar bill and go to the machine and just get a Coke, but it feels very, very differently. And I frankly worry about moving from a society that is removed from cash. We have PayPal and we have electronic transaction, and whether those things actually make it easier for us to cheat and feel good about ourselves. Story number one. Story number two. So, you know, in economic terms, a lot of the decisions we do are about money, about decisions to buy. And we have a lot of experience with deciding whether we want to pay for something this amount or not to this amount. And the question is, how do we do that? And if you reflect on it for a minute, you would realize that it's actually quite a hard challenge. Think about a piece of chocolate. It's a Godiva truffle. It has a little nut inside. You chew it. You smell the aroma. You feel the sweetness. The nut is stuck in your teeth. And then I ask you, how much is this experience worth in terms of money? What's your maximum willingness to pay for it? It's incredibly hard to figure out. I mean, you probably have a range. It's somewhere between 25 cents and $4, but or $5. But where is it? And how do you actually do that? Seems to be quite hard. Is pricing things one of those things that we actually are really not good at? So here's how we try to look at this. We came to a big class of students. By the way, we've done this many times. And we asked people to give us their social security number. Not the whole number, just the last 2 digits. So what's yours, for example? Just you make up 2 numbers. 0-1. Very good choice. You'll see why. So we asked people to write down the last 2 digits of the social security number. And then we asked them for each product that we show them to say whether they would pay that price. So in your case, it will be whether you would pay $1 for all of those. Somebody whose social security number ended at 89 will talk about whether they will pay $89 for each of those. Okay, everybody did that. And then we said, now please submit a bid. We'll have an auction like eBay. Everybody submits their bid. The winner gets the product and pays. Everybody understands the rules. People submit their bids. The highest winners win. We give them the product. They pay the money. Everybody goes home. And now we calculate the relationship between people's social security number and their bids. Now, it sounds like a very strange idea, right? Why would your ending of your social security number should influence how much you're willing to pay for something, right? As if you were endowed with some preference when you were born. So you with 01 are cheap, right? And you'll pay a little for anything. Somebody who was born with a high price will pay a lot. But it turns out that it's not just about the number you were born with or given. It's about contemplating the first decision in those regards. So the people that ended with 01 thought about these products first, about would I pay a dollar for this, yes or no? People who ended in 89 thought, would I pay $89 for those? The question is whether you make an initial hypothetical crazy decision about a strange number, whether it sticks with you for your next decision. That's the question. And it turns out that the correlation between social security number and how much people are willing to pay is about 0.5. People who have ending numbers between 0 and 20 and people who have ending number between 80 versus to 99, there's a more than 100% difference in how much these people are willing to pay for those things. How can it be? I mean, it just seems so strange. So let me tell you a little story. First of all, let me give you an introduction. Do you know a herding model in economics are models about following other people? So the best example for a herding model is you walk down the street and you see two empty restaurants. You don't know anything about it. What do? You pick one at random. Somebody else comes by. They see one restaurant with one person, one with nothing. Where do they go? The person with one person. Somebody else comes. What do they see? Two and zero. They go. Eventually, you have one restaurant is a big hit, one is a failure. Now, how can that be? This is herding. The idea is that we follow other people even when it's not rational. By the way, this is also a very sad story because every time there's a fire somewhere and people escape, there's always empty entrances that nobody went through. And when people see a huge mass of people running to a certain way, everybody tries to run in the same way. I mean, it's also very sad. So now, imagine that this herding behavior doesn't happen just when we look at other people. Imagine that it also happens when we look at ourselves. So to illustrate how this would work, let's think about Starbucks. So think 10 years ago, Starbucks just came on the scene. You have been happy buying Dunkin' Donut coffee for a while, for 50 cents, let's say. And all of a sudden, you're walking down the street. You're thirsty, you're hungry, you're running some annoying errands. You feel like coffee. And you see Starbucks. You don't know what it is, but you decide to go in. You're surprised by the price. It's kind of staggering as an initial thing. But you decide to buy coffee anyway. You buy coffee. The coffee is perfectly fine. You go away. 3 days later, you pass by. What do you remember? Do you remember how you felt 3 days ago? I mean, reflect on it for a minute. Do you remember how you felt yesterday at a particular moment? It's very hard. Do you remember how thirsty you were, caffeinated, deprived? We don't remember any of those. But we do remember our actions. You remember what you bought. And so you say, I remember this before. I did this before. I was here and I decided to go into Starbucks. That must mean that I'm the kind of Starbucks person. And you stand in line behind yourself, right? It's as if you're taking your own past behavior as evidence of how you should behave, and you just repeat that. 2 days later, you do it again and again and again until it becomes a habit. You no longer think about this. You just keep on repeating that behavior, and that creates a stream of decision. That's exactly what happened in our anchoring experiment. Once people thought about something once, the second time they wanted to think about it, somebody said, yes, I would pay $1 for this, or no, I wouldn't pay $89 for this. The second time they came to think about this, they said, well, I just said yes to $1, so I probably will pay more. How much? Well, maybe $10. Or somebody said, well, I said 89 is too expensive. How much would I pay? Well, maybe 70. But the first decision penetrated the rest of the decision. Maybe something else about Starbucks. And I like Starbucks in general, so it's not a thing against them. You can ask the question of how could Starbucks ever succeeded? How did they convince us to start paying $2.50 when we were used to paying 50 cents? I mean, you could say maybe our social security number, the anchor, the starting point was Dunkin' Donuts. So considering the following thought experiment, what do you think would have been Starbucks' success if they had the same store arrangement as Dunkin' Donuts, if their logo was brown and orange and white, and if they had the same coffee quality as they actually had? Do you think we would have been willing to pay 5 times more for coffee under those circumstances? No way. So what Starbucks wanted to tell us was that our initial decisions in coffee, our Dunkin' Donut decision, are irrelevant. So what do? They try to make the coffee store as different as possible. They were selling French presses, and there were all these French pastries, and you couldn't get a small coffee. You had to have the whole new lingo of ordering coffee. And by doing that, they convinced us that we can't use the old reference price, old habits, into this new thing. And they kept on doing it, and we got used to their new anchor. We got used to the social security number that they were giving us. Over time, of course, if you look now at Starbucks, it's Dunkin' Donuts of 10 years ago. I'm not talking about the coffee quality. I don't even know if it's better, but let's assume the coffee quality is better. But now they are selling donuts, and they have chocolate chip cookies and oatmeal cookies, and it's basically not not Starbucks how it started, but now they can allow it to themselves because they've shifted dramatically how we think about coffee and our willingness to pay. Our habits have changed. Okay. Let me say one more thing about this. This basically says that if you think about supply and demand, what is supply and demand? These are kind of the two forces of every economic analysis. Supply is what the market can produce at each price. Demand is how much we are going to consume at each price. We assume that those are independent forces. You remember these kind of X kind of graphs from Intro Micro 101. It assumes that these forces are independent, and therefore the equilibrium is a function of both of these independent forces. But as we show, your first decision really has a long input, and our first decision is done usually as a function of the supply. What does it mean? We see an MSRP at some price. We see a car starting at some price, and we basically just go for that price. So it's not so much about our internal preferences. In fact, we don't really know how much we're willing to pay for something, like the chocolate I gave you in the beginning. And we see the market prices posted out there, and we just accept them in a certain level and build our willingness to pay on top of those. I promised I wouldn't talk for too long. Professors, we're used to like hour and a half slots or 3 hour slots. It's not. let me tell you what do I think is behavioral economics. So behavioral economics is a discipline that is interested in our economic behaviors, but without assuming people are rational. And in some sense, you could say, why do you attack poor economists? I mean, what, is this fun? Is it like, going after the little retarded kid? I mean, it's not it's not a big deal. Why not going after historians, sociologists? I mean, the issue is as follows. Nobody would have attacked economists on this thing if economists did not have this influence that they have on policy and law. So economics is a beautiful study. It's a wonderful perspective to have on life, but it's not complete. And when you come to take a particular piece of study and to use it to make recommendation for taxes, healthcare, education, and so on, you want to be as complete as possible. So I don't want to say that economics should be different. Economics is wonderful just as it is. But when we come to use any particular discipline to make policy recommendation, then I just want it to be as accurate as possible. It's not just about the insights you could have within economics. It is about being accurate. So from my perspective, before we give out $800 billion in taxes, it would be nice to figure out what effect this would have, not just according to economic reasoning, assuming that everybody is rational, or I'm on some panel that is looking at the No Child Left Behind. It would be really nice to figure out how are incentives going to work out in this system and take some evidence into account, not just our beliefs about how people should behave. The other thing is that a lot of people think about behavioral economics as depressing. How many people here have in their life vowed to diet and then the waiter comes with some fancy dessert tray and you succumb to temptation? So anybody? Not here? Some other places? We make these mistakes over and over. This book is partially autobiographical about my mistakes. And you can think of it as very depressing, right? I mean, we think of ourselves as noble, wonderful human being, but in fact, we make these foolish mistakes over and over. The good news, I think, is that there is opportunity for improvement, and that's kind of the promise of behavioral economics, is if you think that we're irrational, it also means that there are ways to improve things, right? We can think about how do we improve healthcare, how do we improve saving, how do we build things that are better? And, in the physical domain, when we come to design products, we design chairs, we design books, we design pens, we take people's physical limitations into account, right? We don't build pencils for Superman. I mean, we build it for us, knowing what we can and can't do. But somehow when we build products for the mind, health insurance policies, savings accounts, retirement savings, all of those things, we somehow assume that people are perfectly rational. It would be great if we could take the same insights and set the same limitations we have in the physical domain we might have also in the cognitive domain, and let's take them into account when we think about what we want to design for policies, for companies, and so on. So that's my spiel. I will be delighted to take questions. Any questions?
Congratulations! This is wonderful. Actually, I don't think it's depressing at all. If anything, if we want to know how irrational we are, so, you know, so we can actually be aware of it and therefore be rational to compensate for that irrationality. I think it's good to know. So anyway, but I want to pick up actually with the last thing you said, because that caught my attention, in terms of suggestions that you might have about policies for retirement accounts or healthcare or whatever, those kinds of things. What would be the policy changes that you would have in mind? Thank you.
Okay. So it turns out that there's a kind of one way to be rational and about a million ways to be irrational. And so there's a lot of things that you can think about fixing. I'll give you one example. So as a university professor, one of the things I encounter repeatedly is procrastination. I'm sure that once you get out of school, you don't know what this is, but university students have procrastination problems. So every semester, the students in my class come with really good intentions. They have clean notebooks and so on. They said they'll catch up with the reading, they'll be ahead. And toward the end of the semester, you know, there's a lot of dead relatives and illnesses and all kinds of things. So one year I offered them the following deal. I said, look, you have to submit 3 papers for me this term, but you could submit them anytime you want. But your deadline that you will commit to me today are binding. And if you're late from your deadline, you will get a penalty. So think about it. If a student was rational, what should they have done? Set all the deadlines to the end of the semester. Why take any risk? But if the student were procrastinators, and they knew that if the class ended, let's say, May 5th, that they would only start working on it May 4th, and they will work 24 hours straight, and they will produce something terrible, they will space their assignments, and maybe will actually do better. And the good news is that people did that. So the students spaced their assumptions, they spaced their deadlines, and they actually got better. Now, the interesting thing is that since then, I give this paper out to my students in the beginning of each semester, nobody ever comes to me and said, Professor Ariely, can you please force us to submit our papers earlier? Or here is my promise to you that you could deduct payments if I don't submit this on time. Nobody by themselves is coming with this mechanism, but the moment I gave them a mechanism, they knew how to use it. Now, let's go back to healthcare. So we're testing now the same idea in healthcare. So imagine that, I'll pick a man. Imagine I schedule a colonoscopy for you. May 15th. What's the chance you'll wake up that morning and feel like today is a good day for colonoscopy? So, but what if today when I schedule your colonoscopy, I say, I'm giving you a chance. You can write me a check for $500. And I will deposit the check if you don't show up your exam on time. Okay? If you understand, if you're sophisticated and you say, well, I know that when I wake up I will on the 15th of May, I will not feel like it. But if I give you a check, then I will go. And the good news is that when we test this kind of idea, about 50% of the people are willing to take more expensive policies that would force them to behave better. So that's kind of one idea of how do you take some kind of insights and get people to force themselves to behave better. Of course, there's other approaches.
But if we look at Obama and Hillary, they both sound about the same, but there's herd instinct there. Could you map your hypotheses to both the currency arbitrage and what's going on in the debates between those two names who I forget?
Let me say a couple, one comment on each of those topics. Let me say one thing about the subprime mortgage crisis. It's kind of a crazy idea to figure out, to assume that people would be able to compute how much money they can borrow. I mean, just imagine you had to do this computation, ask you what's the optimal amount of money that you should borrow. First of all, it depends on what you're buying. I mean, you can't say independently of this, but it's really a hard calculation to do. I'm not even sure that somebody who has an MBA can compute it accurately. And then we go and we expect every person to be able to compute that on their own. I think that's just a mistake. In fact, I have a position in the Federal Reserve Bank, and my job there is to fight with the local economists. And a few years ago, there was this issue about interest-only mortgages. And the guys in my department wrote this wonderful letter about a wonderful paper about how wonderful interest-only mortgages are. Why? Because they provide this incredible flexibility. And then we looked for evidence. What evidence did they find? It turns out that people with higher credit card debt were more likely to take interest-only mortgages. And they say, here's the proof that it's working. Why? Because if you have a high credit card debt, an interest-only mortgage is great for you because you could take the extra money and pay your expensive loan. Another perspective could be that if somebody was irresponsible enough to get a high interest, a high debt on a credit card, they might not be perfectly responsible when it comes to take the mortgages. Now, I didn't predict this market crash, but I think there were a lot of institutional things we didn't think about. Let me say one more thing about Obama and Hillary, actually just about Obama. We had this incredible belief in Obama's ability. In fact, if you think about the distribution of all politicians in the U.S., he's kind of out there as an outlier, maybe with JFK, right? It's just him and those two guys. And the question is, how can people be so enamored and have such high expectations? So let me tell you about some research we've done on online dating, and you'll see why. Because I think it is about love more than opinion. So we found out that when you know less about people, you fill the gaps about them in an overly positive way. So somebody says they like music, you immediately assume they like your kind of music. They like art, or it must be the kind. And I think that's one of the things that happened with Obama. We know so little about him, and we fill the gaps in a really optimistic way. We really want the next Democratic candidate to be useful. And we fill the gaps in a very, very positive way. And because we don't know much about him, we can do that. The sad thing about it is that in online dating, the people who meet the first time get crushed. Because the moment they learn something about the other person, they get disappointed, and there's an escalation of disappointment. So one of the questions for me for Obama is whether he will be able to maintain this lack of knowledge, not just until the Democrats make their choices, but until the general elections. Because the worst thing for the Democrat could be that he maintains this lack of knowledge and love until the Democratic nomination. And then after that, as information is revealed, there's more and more falling out of love.
So you've given some mechanistic approaches for policy. What about personal approaches for people to choose the fire exits where there are no other people? What are our set points? How do we remember that we are irrational? And, well, if there's nobody at that exit, maybe we can get out faster.
Yeah. So again, the point is that there's a lot of ways to be irrational, and we can think about some of those warning signs. So I'll tell you some of my personal stories. So a few years ago, we had to buy a new car, and the sensible thing would be to buy a minivan. We were just about to have our second kid, and then I also kind of drove around, and there was a little cute red sports car. Not really sporty, but for four people, really not sensible. And I knew that the minivan was clearly the better option, but this other one was tempting. And then one day they had a great deal, and the deal was that you get a free oil change for 3 years, right? This was fantastic. And I went for that car. And for a while, I was driving it for months. And I was thinking, my goodness, I got this free oil change for 3 years. And I felt so good about it. And only about 4 months later, I calculated that this was like worth $150. You know, they could have given me a $1,000 discount. And it wouldn't have made me want to buy the little car over the minivan. But the moment they phrase something as free, it became so tempting to me that I fell to this trap. So going back to your question, now when I see free, I stop. And I slow down and I see, what am I really giving up when I fall? Am I falling for a free trap or not? And there's all kinds of other traps, and you'll see some of the other ones. But that's one of the things we can do.
I saw an article. I was interested in your perceptions on cheating. I saw an article in the paper last week that there was a man who went to his bank, and he thinks he has a couple of $1,000s in his account. And he goes to the bank and he checks his balance. And he's told, no, sir, you have $1,000,000 in your account. And the bank had made an error and put money into his account, which was actually, of course, someone else's money. This man decided, for reasons that I'm not thinking of, that he was going to withdraw a large amount of this money and spend it on various things. And, you know, it turns out that what had happened is that there were two men with the same name banking at the same bank, and it was someone else's money. So now this poor, unfortunate man's being prosecuted for the theft of a large amount of money. I was thinking to myself, what would most people do in that situation where you walk up to the bank, you think you have $1,000, and the bank tells you no, you have $1,000,000? What is the thought process that most people would go through in that kind of a situation, do you think?
Yeah. So I think most people would try to rationalize as much of this as possible. I think rationalizing $1 million would be tough, but I think if it was $3,000, it would have been easier. But the other thing is, it's a question of how much they hate the bank. And I'll tell you a little story about this. So we've been doing experiments on annoying people and seeing how much money they will take from us. So we hire an acting undergrad student from BU, and we get them to go to people in coffee shops in Boston, and he comes to them and he says, "I have this task. It takes 5 minutes. I'll give you $5. Would you mind doing it?" They say no. He gives them the task. He explains to them what they need to do. They need to find like letter combinations. It's really boring. 5 minutes later, he comes back. He gives them the money. He said, "Here's your $5. Count in, sign the receipt, and just leave it here. I'll be back." And he actually gives them $9. It's not a million, but instead of five, he gives them nine. The question is, will they return the money? But what we also do is sometimes he annoys them. And the way he annoys them is that when he explains to them what the task is, he picks up his cell phone and he pretends that somebody just called him. And he talks about pizza and stuff tonight for 12 seconds. That's it, a short conversation. Then he continues without acknowledging or without anything. People return much less money after being annoyed. And I think the deal is that they can rationalize it much better. They make sense of it. They said, "Well, he took some of this, he did this," and they make peace with this ability of taking more money. One last thing about this experiment: it turns out that it doesn't matter if the student described the research as his own and his own money, or describe it as me, Dan's research and my money. So it's a kind of an agent principle thing. You know, somebody in the gap is annoying you. Now, if they forgot to scan one of your shirts, it's not that person who's going to suffer, it's the store. But it turns out it doesn't matter to people. When you get annoyed, it will just hurt anybody to get a feeling of justice back.
Well, actually, along those lines, one thing I heard is that if people feel that they're being poorly treated or underpaid at work, that they'll take more things because they have a sense of entitlement or justice.
Right.
So that fits.
Yeah, there's a very nice analysis showing. Do you remember the Firestone tires? You remember that tragedy with all the cars? It turns out that you can trace that problem to a labor union dispute in the factory. So people were really unhappy with Firestone at the moment, and then the reason they produce lower quality tires. So you're absolutely right.
Okay, and I have another comment. I'm also a social scientist, clinical and political psychologist. And in any profession, you have ethical standards, practice, that you have to use practices that have been proven effective. You're not allowed to practice outside your area of training. In politics, you don't. You're allowed to completely make stuff up, and it only affects millions and billions of people. So, I mean, I'm glad you're doing this with economic policy, but our policies, say, with you know, military action, nuclear proliferation, terrorism, retaliation, has the exact opposite effect, that if you make people afraid, you make them more dangerous. We're driving extremism. But people can – we totally get away from it. And, you know, the American public has been seduced into believing it, maybe a little bit less now, but people don't really get that, you know, the way to be, you know, like security assurances.
No.
They call it like appeasement or tension reduction. So
yeah.
Do you have any thoughts about policy or how to affect that or changing consciousness?
Yeah. So here's the story. Let me use the medical domain. So the reason we don't have very strong professional ethics or professional guidelines is because we value flexibility. So if you take a physician and you say to them, never, never, never get any patient to do any kind of treatment on equipment that you own, we're limiting their flexibility, right? What if it's the right thing for a patient? What we don't understand is when we don't have these very strict guidelines, we will fall short. And in our cheating experiment, these were not bad people. These were all good people, but even good people can cheat, but they could cheat a little bit. Now imagine a physician who has this very flexible way to think about life. You know, sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. And now they would gain $5,000 if they would send a patient to take some treatment on their equipment. Even if they're a good person, can they really overcome and not take this into account? Not in a conscious way, saying I'm going to do something with insurance, but see the world from the perspective of somebody who's going to gain $5,000. It's very, very hard. And that's why I think that what is happening is that over the years, we took these very strong, rigid guidelines for lawyers, for physicians, and so on, and we made them more flexible. We can see the value of flexibility. What we don't usually see is the pitfalls in flexibility. And I think we need to understand those pitfalls and then make much stronger guidelines. For example, think about the recent bill in Congress about what do we allow politicians to cheat and not to cheat. It's so ill-defined, and we allow so many degrees of freedom that we basically are tempting people to fail.
Sorry to be annoying, but no. Anyway, as far as
I teach at a university. I.
As far as this, this behavioral economics and stuff, have you or has anybody observed any cultural, measurable cultural differences? Because I would think that if you have a bunch of Germans, in front of an experiment as opposed to a bunch of Ghanaians, surely there might be a little bit of a difference. And my second question basically is, do you have any recommendations for retirement account structuring or whatever besides the healthcare thing? Thanks.
So let me skip the retirement question because we actually have a lot of work on this and it will take a long time. I'm happy to talk to you in a minute about this. Cultural differences. So I'm Israeli, so I did the same experiments on cheating in Israel, did more extreme version when we got a blind person that can't see to take cabs. And the question was, will the cabbies cheat more a blind person than a non-blind person? It turns out it's basically the same. I even tried Italy. A lot of people have this idea that Italians cheat a lot. We didn't get any difference. We did get one important difference in India. So I hired this research assistant over the web, and she ran the experiment in India, and we made one big change is that we gave people a lot of money for each question. So we run experiments from time to time in India because some economists say, yeah, you're dealing with little money. What's about when it's big? So in India, we paid people about 500 rupees per question. It's $10, and you can think about being for them about $500 per question. So there's a lot of money. Turns out there was absolutely no cheating. But I don't know why. Here are three reasons. Why? Hinduism, one possibility. I'm not sure this is it. The second, it was too much money, that you can't cheat a little bit when every question is $500. The third possibility is that only men were tested. For some reason, I didn't know why, but I met the woman who was testing it, and it turned out to be a really beautiful woman. So there might be some other issues there. but in general, we don't find many cultural differences. You can think about those things as more basic than things that are influenced by culture. To a large degree, there's some exceptions. Yes.
So I think it's really, really fascinating, these observations you've made about human behavior. The thing that I find a little bit troubling, though, is you often attribute a certain intent to this to these actions. So you say that they cheat because, or they're willing to do this because they're annoyed and that they have some sense of justice and so on. And I think that makes me a bit worried. And how do you come to these conclusions?
Okay, so first of all. Most of the cheating I talked about, I'm not giving people any intent. In fact, I think
but you're
it flies
explaining it by intent.
No. I might not have been clear. I think people kind of cheat up to the level that they're comfortable with, but I don't think it's a cost-benefit analysis that they say, how much would I be comfortable with cheating and still look at myself in the mirror? I think people start cheating a little bit because they have the financial incentives, and what stops them is saying, well, if I'm going to do a little bit more cheating here, I will think of myself as a bad person, and that stops them. But up to that point, it hasn't been deliberative. In fact, people don't do the cost-benefit analysis. The only reason that we get this cheating is because they don't do it. Now, with a sense of kind of fixing justice, I think people feel angry.
Do they? I mean, how do you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I think your results are really impressive, and it's great that you can measure this stuff really precisely, but by explaining things like anger where it doesn't seem that you've conducted experiments.
Yeah, so let me just tell you about the experiment, so this will give you an answer. So it turns out if you wait enough time between you annoy them and between the time that you gave them the money, or it turns out if you say sorry, these effects go away. So that helps me think that it is about anger.
Do you need to explain it in terms of the? I mean, I would think that if you observe this mm-hmm. suboptimal decision-making behavior, that should be sufficient to sort of drive the other arguments you're making in terms of policy decisions and so on without really appealing to, you know, anger or why they're doing these things.
I agree with you. So in policy, you can be a kind of a neoclassical economist or neoclassical behavioral economist and say, I just care about what people behave.
Yeah.
But in this particular case, because we know that anger goes up and goes down, and we know that saying sorry can diffuse anger, and because those two manipulations seems to diffuse that, that phenomena, I feel comfortable thinking that it's anger. But let me just say a general comment. We do little, I think, cute experiments to try and get a little bit of understanding about life. This is not the final word. I mean, we're just making little steps, and this is what science is about, and we're trying to discover a little bit more. And I don't want to sound in any way that I kind of have the final answer about something. It's just the first little baby steps. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings like this one, please visit npr.org/booktour.